It's 9 o'clock and time for How It Works.
Saturday, a regular crowd shuffles in. There's an old man sitting next to me, making love to his tonic and gin.
La-di-di-da, la-di-da. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, we did that song, okay? Now you don't gotta sit there through the whole show and go, when is he gonna do that song? When is he gonna do that song?
And that was Billy Joel live at the Nassau Coliseum in Uniondale, New York, December 11th, 1977. And it's appropriate because today's show is a pre-recorded interview with an adjunct here in the English department, Nicholas Hirshon, who has just recently published a book, which is the Nassau Veterans Memorial Coliseum from the Images of America series. I interviewed Nicholas yesterday afternoon in my office, and I'm going to be playing that back for you today. You're listening to How It Works. I'm your host, Hugo Fernandez. So without further ado, a pre-recorded interview with Nicholas Hirshon, adjunct here in the English department at LaGuardia Community College, and the author of the Nassau Veterans Memorial Coliseum from the Images of America series here on How It Works. Okay, so this is a pre-recorded interview with my guest today, Nicholas Hirshon.
Hirshon.
Trying to get that right. And Nicholas, you are an adjunct here at LaGuardia in the English department, am I correct?
That's correct.
That's right. Okay. We talked a little bit about what I like to do on the show, so why don't we talk a little bit about your background, where you're from, and where you go to school, and things like that.
Okay. Well, I grew up in Queens, so I'm local. I grew up in Forest Hills. I was born in Flushing, and I've lived my entire life in Queens. I've gone to school in Queens. I went to St. John's University in Jamaica for undergrad. I studied journalism there. And then for my master's degree, I went to Columbia University, so I left the borough.
So you have a master's in English?
Master's in journalism.
Master's in journalism. Oh, that's right. That was actually, when I was reading the back cover of the book, I noticed that Columbia Journalism, that's a great school.
Right.
All right. And so how did you end up coming to LaGuardia?
Well, I guess it was in the fall of 2008 I started getting interested in teaching more. I'd always sort of been interested, and it was pretty simple. I sent my resume over to LaGuardia. I guess they had an opening coming up, and a few months later I got a call saying that they were interested.
What kind of courses are you teaching now at the college?
Teaching two journalism courses. It's English 210 and English 211. They're both like introductory journalism courses, but also talking a little bit about the craft of gathering and reporting the news, how to write a news story. And then a few times I've taught English 103, the research paper class.
Okay. Do you know Victor Rosa?
I do. Okay. I work closely with him.
Oh yeah, we talk a lot. Well, Victor is also he's a faculty mentor for the radio station. He and I have kind of interacted as a result. I know he's involved with the Bridge.
Yes.
Do you have any dealings with the Bridge?
I'm a consultant for the Bridge, so I deal a lot with him. He's the advisor, and I'm the consultant.
Oh, okay. So you actually help students with their pieces?
Editing articles, trying to direct some of my students in my classes to write articles for the Bridge, because it's hard to convince people to give that time.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, I remember when I think I was a journalism major for all of about a year in junior college, and I used to just turn my papers in class they would turn them into the articles for the paper that way, but I don't know if that's an option.
I give that option to students. Yeah. I mean, if you're writing it anyway, why not get it published and then have a clip after your class?
Yeah, it's part of the process. It's like when I teach art, we talk about this idea that until somebody sees the object in the context of a museum or a show or whatever the case might be, the process isn't finished.
Right. Well, and the whole point of journalism is writing for the reader, and the reader shouldn't just be your professor. So I like the idea that they can write it, have it published in the Bridge, and now they're writing for other students. They're learning how to write for an audience, not just for themselves or a class.
So writing for the reader, meaning to kind of figure out who you're writing to, that's the audience.
Well, the whole
trying to adapt to that.
Sure. The whole mission of journalism is supposed to be writing for the sake of a reader, educating people, telling them how they can make the best decisions. So just, yeah, letting them know what's going on in their world. And when you're just writing, I think, for a class, maybe you don't really...
Well, they're writing to the professor, aren't they?
Right. You're really writing for one person. And
they usually give you what you want. The best example I use is when my students turn in their first paper and they capitalize the word art. And I put strike through it all the time. And I go, what are you sucking up to me? And trying to make me think, like, you think art's important because they're capitalizing it?
I don't want them to write for me, though, or use vocabulary words that may look great on the SAT, but the typical reader on the street wouldn't understand them. So that's not right. The point of journalism. It's supposed to be something that everybody can get very easily.
I talk about that, too. Like, you know, you can imagine an art, the jargon or a special vocabulary. And a lot of times they skip over trying to elucidate, different points because they're writing to me. I know the answer. I know the objects before, you know, so that's an easy way out. And I've been trying to incorporate hyperlinks as well into writing because a lot of the stuff we do ends up on ePortfolio. So how is it? I know you're adjunct here. Probably your load here is, what, two courses a semester?
Right now it's just one course a semester, actually. And then I also teach at St. John's University, so I have two courses total, just at two different...
And are you writing for any publications?
Yes.
Well?
I'm a reporter at the Daily News, so I work there 4 days a week.
Wow. Yeah. So you got a busy schedule.
Yes.
That's how do you find the LaGuardia students as, given the fact that you're working... The other location is
St. John's University.
So you're saying your alma mater?
Right.
So... I would think you have I don't know if necessarily a different population, but maybe a different, I wouldn't even say level of preparedness, possibly.
I think they're both drawing from the same diversity of Queens. So as far as that, the ethnic, religion, you have that diversity. As far as preparedness, I see sometimes a little bit of an older student maybe at LaGuardia than I would at St. John's. But I feel that they're both pretty well prepared and enthusiastic. So for all those people who say, like, community college students, or just high school dropouts or whatever the stereotypes are that you hear, I think that that's really proven wrong.
We have, we talk about the diversity of the population, ethnic, religion, but there's also, like you said, this age. What time do they come to us? I think that in the last few years, though, we've had younger students coming in. There was always that older element in the community college population, but it's pretty diverse, even though... When you look at the institutional profile, the average LaGuardia student is usually a 21-year-old Asian woman. So you have written something, and you wanted to talk about Tobago, which is the Nassau Veterans Memorial Coliseum.
Right.
And it's part of one of this series, this Images of America, which if the audience is not particularly aware of this, so I think they would if they've been to any bookstore in the last 5 years. It's a series that's become very popular where they take... local history, mm-hmm. and they turn it into something. Oh, we've got the Images of America series celebrates the history of neighborhoods, towns, and cities across the country using archival photographs. Each title presents the distinctive stories from the past that shape the character of the community today. Arcadia is proud to play a part in the preservation of local heritage, making history available to all. But it gives you kind of ArcadiaPublishing.com is the publisher. But yeah, it's any neighborhood, like for example, in my neighborhood, Fort Greene, Brooklyn, mm-hmm. they have a little one for that.
Right.
I was recently in Washington, and I was staying in this African-American bed and breakfast. It was focused on African-American writers, literary figures, and on a particular... I think it was U Street or U Avenue. I can't remember whether it was an avenue or a street. But they had one of these just on U Street,
right.
This old African-American community in or neighborhood in Washington, D.C. So it's kind of it's interesting how I thought it was, they're focusing even more and more on more discreet neighborhood histories. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of exciting. So how did this whole project come about?
Well, it started because one of my friends, a guy named Jason Antos, wrote a few books of Arcadia.
Okay.
He wrote one about Shea Stadium, and I'm a big Mets fan. So I, of course,
How do you feel about the Mets right now? How do you feel about the they're in a bit of turmoil, right?
Yeah, well, right now we've got to see what GM they get. They're looking for a general manager
and
a new manager, of course.
Right.
The state of the Mets. Can we talk about the Islanders instead? Does that say it all right
talk
now? I'm glad we're in hockey season. Can we talk about the New York Islanders instead?
If you want, but I had this, and this is, once again, I thought the last time I was a hockey fan is when I lived in Boston in the early 70s, and Bobby Orr was, you know, the main figure at that time, and I wanted to be, you know, the shortest defenseman after him in the NHL, and the first Hispanic one maybe at the time. But so it's been a while since I've been a hockey fan, so you're going to have to help me out when we start talking about
sure,
hockey.
No problem.
But yeah, are the Islanders doing well?
Right now they are.
I'm a Rangers fan, believe it or not. The little bit I
can I leave now?
Am into hockey. It's all right. There's room for everybody here. But so your friend had already written a few of these, few titles?
Right. So Jason Antos had written a few titles. He's now written four of them. He wrote one about Whitestone, the neighborhood where he lives in Queens. He wrote Queens Then and Now and went on Flushing Then and Now, which I wrote the foreword to, actually.
Oh, very nice.
And then he wrote that Shea Stadium book. So I had asked him, what's the process like? And, of course, since I grew up rooting for the Mets and the Islanders, so he sort of stole the Mets before I could get to it.
Right.
But I asked him, do you think that they would be interested in a book on something as small as Nassau Coliseum? Because nobody's really written anything about it, and he encouraged me, so.
So, is it just that you were an Islanders fan, or is it something about that space that called you? For example, I mean, once again, I'm a Yankee fan. So, which is kind of interesting. It's amazing we can be in the studio together.
Right.
But I'm a Yankee fan, and so I had a lot of feelings about the recent, well, basically the demoing of the house that Ruth built.
Sure.
And setting it, you know, setting up shop across the street. Though since then, of course, I've been there, and though, you pay through the nose for anything you get there, it's a pretty good experience.
Right.
I don't think anyone would deny that. But I had feelings about the old stadium, and remembering as a child visiting, even though I think we always used to get obstructed view seats, if I can remember correctly. But, you know, and the games that I attended, my fiance, who's my girlfriend then, you know, for my birthday got me tickets for one of the last games in the stadium before they demoed it. Was it 2 years ago? Last year? Yeah, 2 years ago.
2008.
So, right. Yeah, so. But, is there something about this space?
Yes. I mean, beyond the Islanders, I think that Nassau Coliseum in general is a very underappreciated venue. There's really not been much written about it. So as opposed to Yankee Stadium, we all know there's been novels, libraries full of books about Yankee Stadium and the Yankees players.
Pains have been written.
Yes.
As they would say.
And I guess to a lesser extent, it's the same way for Shea Stadium and for Madison Square Garden. I mean, these are, since they're in New York City, I think that there's this just overload of information out there about them.
Sure, I think the only one that could rival is probably, Red Sox, the
Fenway Park.
Fenway Park.
Yeah,
exactly right.
So,
once again.
And those are all arenas or stadiums have great histories. I don't dispute that, but I always like the opportunity of a challenge and the fact that this was never done before.
Right.
And also the Nassau Coliseum gets such a bad reputation because if you've ever been to the building, if you looked at it, you drive in, it's like this big empty parking lot. There's nothing around, it seems, for
well, that's what I loved miles. About it. I actually have a little bit of history with this space because my daughter was a big Disney princess fan, and they were doing Disney Princesses on Ice a couple of years in a row. So we ended up, I was trying to figure out if there were other ice skating, you know, air venues, like, but there can't be of this size. So it has to be the Nassau Coliseum, and I enjoyed myself. Well, but it is your time, and it's funny because I come from Florida, where that's the way they build things. They build a building in the middle of this kind of desert of parking, and Dodger Stadium, I guess, was like that as compared to an Ebbets Field. But in New York, we're used to this other experience where, for example, the Garden,
right,
which is right in the heart of it all. I mean, even Yankee Stadium is, you know, surrounded. Shea has a little more space.
Yeah, although still I think you have the public transportation is so close by. You have the U.S. Open, you know, the number
right.
7 train and all the highways with the Coliseum. It really has this feeling of you're in the middle of nowhere. Why did they put this arena here?
Well, it speaks to, and I was, you know, in preparing for the show, I told you that I had gone on Amazon. Folks who are interested in the book can go check out some of the pages on Amazon, some of the opening remarks, the acknowledgement, and some of your beginning statements and images that Robert Moses plays an integral part. And anybody who knew what Moses was about was, you know, his worship of the automobile. And so anything that he got involved with. So I know I mean, as far as securing the land, I guess that was the beginning. Later on with the design, I don't know how much he really had to do with it.
Right.
But, you know, you knew you were going to drive there if Moses had something to do with it.
That's definitely a fair assumption of anything Robert Moses. It was not so much about people but about cars, although he didn't have as much to do with the design of it, but he was important in changing its use from an Air Force base to something educational, civic, cultural, which became the Coliseum idea.
Yeah, let's talk about it. I mean, do you want to talk a little bit about the timeline of the history of it?
Sure.
Or, and we've talked about, since I've never had an author here who's actually talking about his book, I'd like you to read maybe an important passage for you, but what you want to talk a little bit about the timeline of the history of the Coliseum?
Sure. Yeah, so the area where the Coliseum is today used to be Mitchell Field Air Force Base. Every now and then, if you listen to 1010 Winds, and they'll say the Islanders play tonight at Mitchell Field, and I always used to wonder, what do they mean at Mitchell Field? Will they play at the Coliseum? Are they playing in Uniondale, Long Island? But that's what they're referring to. So some people still call it Mitchell Field. And it was an Air Force base used in World War I and into World War II. Also, a lot of famous aviation pioneers were there, Charles Lindbergh, Admiral Byrd. And what happened, though, is when it was first built, it was in a world where there's nobody really living nearby. So it's perfect for a place where you're going to have lousy planes and crashes and all these experiments going on, because you don't need to worry about, oh, if it falls, it'll just fall on a field and, you know, probably nothing much will happen. What happened later on is that area got developed.
Right. So, Levittown is a stone's throw?
Yep. Yeah. Levittown was one of the first areas that got developed around the Coliseum site. East Meadow you have, and then the homes in Uniondale. So we're entering the 1950s, the 1960s, and as these residences are sprouting up around this site, it becomes more and more dangerous to have an Air Force base.
Such as, so then now you're looking at a LaGuardia JFK scenario.
Right. You're looking at that, although even those things create so much traffic and congestion and pollution. But what they were really having a problem was with aircraft accidents, where you would have accidents and they would actually kill people on the ground at homes nearby or damage their property.
Right. So because this is definitely like a second tier airport. This was a small planes and military.
Right. Mainly military Air Force activity, and then they would allow some other pioneers, people like Lindbergh, you know, to take off there or work on their airplanes there. But yeah, we're not talking about a lot of activity in the commercial
international
sense.
Flights or anything like any large jumbo jet kind of activity. So they closed. But basically, it became obsolete for two reasons. One is, I guess they moved the bases to other locations, but also the fear of the airplane accidents.
The accidents, and they also was a fear about during a time of war. You don't want to endanger the people who are living around an Air Force base, because that becomes a target.
Right.
So you would hate to see something happen, and I guess around World War II, you're thinking about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and if something like that would happen, at least have it in an isolated area where they eliminate the base, but not everybody else.
Yeah. Or I guess at the time of that, a lot of the legislation comes in that I was reading about, that now we are into the Cold War, so being kind of a ground zero for a thermonuclear device or something.
Sure.
Hitting that site.
Exactly.
So then in comes Moses.
Well, Moses is one of those people, and if you know anything about Robert Moses, he has this reputation of getting things done. Right.
And he held the chairmanship of almost every committee in the state at the time.
And at this time, he was president of Long Island Parks Commission.
Right.
Right. So since he has that reputation, they turn to him, and he's one of the people who convinces the Air Force you should close this space or relocate. So there's some fights about whether they should stay open or there should be an airport there. But eventually, he partners with the county executive at the time, Eugene Nickerson, to create some sort of a civic center. And at first, there was talk about something named after John F. Kennedy, because he had recently been assassinated, and having maybe schools on the site, library, concert space, concert hall, as well as an arena. But the arena almost seemed a little bit like an afterthought. And as it turned out, when they started looking at the budget, they started scratching everything off the list. And before you know it,
was all that was left.
All you have left is an arena and a parking lot. So it's interesting to look at some of the photos of what they were planning. And
once again, there's a lot of photographs actually on the Amazon site as well.
Mm-hmm.
So if you get an opportunity to go on there, you'll see it. And I noticed that a lot of it focused on the construction.
Right. Well, the first chapter is really all about the Air Force base, so some of the photos of what was happening when it was active as an Air Force base, and then moving on to the construction stage, what it looked like, a lot of vintage photographs from Newsday, which was covering it at the time, and blueprints, behind the scenes, early years.
I was also looking, there was a lot of remarks made about the design of it, I saw. I think, in fact, one of the chapters you call it "Hat in a Box" or
"Unveiling a Stone Hat Box."
Yeah, but
the first chapter.
But once again, through the construction photos, talking about a lot of the innovations that make it an ideal venue for viewing something like a hockey game, which mm-hmm. tends to draw smaller crowds. But once again, it's like, you know, every seat is a great seat. There's no obstruction as a result of some of the construction techniques.
That's something I think a lot of visitors to the Coliseum notice. So when you're outside, you just see sort of a bland concrete facade, nothing really out of the ordinary, and that's what's been criticized for so often. But when you're inside...
The exterior.
Right, the exterior just looks sort of boring and dull.
Right.
When you're inside, though, the sight lines that you're discussing really come to light, and the fact that there isn't really a bad seat in the house,
yeah.
especially with something like hockey, you feel this intimate atmosphere. I think it's more pertinent with hockey than with some other sports, where you really want to feel like you're part of the game. You can feel the hits.
I'm going to take a break for a second here. You're listening to How It Works. It's 9:30 a.m., and I'm your host, Hugo Fernandez, on LaGuardia Web Radio, WLGCC. And you're listening to a pre-recorded interview with the author Nicholas Hirshon and also an adjunct professor of English journalism here at LaGuardia Community College. He's talking about his book, Nassau Veterans Memorial Coliseum, from the Images of America series. I recorded the interview yesterday afternoon and playing it back for you today. So I just wanted to stop for a second and check in to remind you where you are. Back to the interview. Once again, here on How It Works, LaGuardia Web Radio, WLGCC. But, you know, this discussion of the nosebleed seats, and mm-hmm. it is that case. I mean, you know, you're definitely going to get a better experience watching at home and just feeling completely disconnected from the experience.
Right.
But I remember, yeah, once again, when I took my daughter, we were a little bit up, but we had great seats, you know.
Yeah, I think that was one of the very few positives that came out of the construction, I guess, is that they designed a stadium that's very functional. So even if you look at it and you say it's not pretty to the eye, it serves its purpose very well.
And I noticed one of the things, I guess, the controversy, and the gentleman who mentioned he was one of the general managers at one time.
Lance Elder.
Yeah, he talked about they were in a hurry to make this thing available. And it's kind of interesting because I think today they would never have taken the kinds of shortcuts. I mean, given the litigiousness of our society, I mean, opening up a venue that didn't have railings. I mean,
incomplete.
People could have dropped off the side, walking up very steep stairways without handles. I mean, the Americans with Disabilities Act would have had a field day with this space. But it seemed like there was a big rush to make this thing happen and open up.
Right. Well, they were supposed to have about 16,000 seats, something like that. And for the first event, which was a Nets game in February 1972, they only had about 8,000, probably less, available.
Yeah.
And there's a story of one woman going to her seats with her kids, and then the seats aren't installed yet. or guys are still drawing the traction numbers with chalk on the side of the arena and everything. So there were a lot of last-minute arrangements that had to be made.
But then I guess, and for you, and it even shows from the cover, which is the Islanders game, it would go on to be the setting, like so many great sports venues, for history.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed in your introduction, you know, focusing on, and once again, I was wondering if it was going to turn into a lot of hockey play-by-play, because, for example, crossing the blue line, as the puck crosses the blue line, I picked up on the quality of that sentence, but I was saying, so what is it? The blue line is that's the halfway, or is that the quarter, the last quarter of the rink?
That's your own zone. The red line is the center ice.
Oh, the red line is center. So the blue zone.
Blue line is like you have to be within the The blue line when
in order to shoot?
To shoot the puck.
I never understand offsides in hockey.
Offsides is when you've crossed the blue line with the puck when there's already a player in that zone, an offensive player in that zone. So if you're an offensive team.
So nobody can be waiting for the puck
exactly.
beyond the blue line.
Exactly, because otherwise it would just be too easy to have a breakaway because you just have one guy standing at the blue line.
I think of, that's like the 72 Olympics when the Russians had a guy standing under the net and they kept throwing it in at 3 seconds. Until they sank it, and
that's exactly
the East German judges or the West German judges, whoever the judges were, basically keep blowing the whistle and calling it back until they could get that score. But okay, so now I've learned something. we're well into the interview, and I wanted to give you an opportunity. So now that I've mentioned some of the history, maybe is there a particular section from the book a passage that you'd like to read?
Sure, I can read if you want the introduction.
Okay.
The first few paragraphs.
Yeah, maybe so.
Which sort of leads into what we were talking about, because we left off with sort of the construction of the arena, and now we're talking a little bit more about hockey and the Islanders' history there.
Right.
So I decided to start the book with probably the most famous moment in Nassau Coliseum's history, and then take a step back, because I figured you start it, grab people's attention with something that's really exciting that they remember.
Yeah, start in the middle.
Exactly. You start in the middle, start in 1980.
That's just good writing.
I'm hoping.
Yeah.
And then you just step back and really show them how it got to that point and what's happened since. So I'll just read the introduction. Moments before the face-off, Bob Nystrom pulled his hand from its blue and orange glove and scratched his cheek. It was overtime on Long Island, and Nystrom itched with the sweat of a fierce series. His New York Islanders, mocked as chokers after several failed playoff runs, now needed just one goal to win the Stanley Cup. The home club lined up opposite the Philadelphia Flyers, while the faithful roared at Nassau Veterans Memorial Coliseum. Philadelphia, in its defensive zone, corralled the puck off the draw. Then an errant pass through center ice found an Islander stick. Fans pulsed with anticipation. In sudden death, as both sides knew, a seemingly harmless possession could swiftly develop into a score and a triumph. So Islanders centerman Lorne Henning hoped, as he guided a neutral zone feed to John Tinelli. Crowd noise jumped an octave. Racing over the blue line, Tinelli pushed the puck to Nystrom. Blade met rubber disc. Not every spectator saw the black speck cross the goal line, but they certainly realized. Nystrom's weary arms shot in the air. Henning hugged him first, then Tinelli, then the rest of the new champions of hockey. On May 24th, 1980, Long Island had arrived. So that's how the book opens up, and to give you that drama of what happened that moment when the Islanders win their very first Stanley Cup, and then take the step back of how did we get to that point, and a little bit more in depth about the Stanley Cup years.
When you were studying journalism, were you interested in being a sports journalist?
For a while. Actually, when I was at St. John's, my minor was sports management. And one of the classes that I took was called Arena and Stadium Management, and it was taught by the guy who wrote the foreword to this book,
Lance Elder.
So I was already interested in the Coliseum before then, and just to have him teaching a class, I had no idea going in that he was general manager of the Coliseum.
At the time.
I guess at that time he had
retired.
Just left.
Okay.
But still, he had 2 decades of experience there, and he loved talking about all his old stories, and I just loved hearing them. So went through his class, which was 7:35 in the morning class, but he got us through it with funny stories about concerts and Islanders games and things. And later on, I was able to turn to him and say, can you help me while I'm writing this book, do research,
so you
find photos?
A relationship with, and this is something I try to impress on students, which is that, you know, you need to get to know your professors, because you're going to need them down the road for nothing else. A letter of recommendation.
Mm-hmm.
It's not to make friends with my students or anything. I'm not saying necessarily I'm the one, but along the road that you really need to start building up relationships with your professors.
Or at least making
they can come help you down the road.
Or making at least a positive impression. I mean, I can't say that I spoke to him every day in between the time my class ended and I called him about this book, but just the fact that I think he remembered or he knew, like, okay, this was one of the good guys. And I'll give him a few photos. And I think that it's important to keep that in mind, because you never know. I didn't think I was going to write a book about the Coliseum. It just sort of happened.
I'm actually in the process now of trying to contact somebody from where I got my master's, and just to check in about some information. We have a visiting artist, and find out, hey, did you know this guy when he was there? Tell me about him. And and that kind of stuff, and it helps to be able to call. Though I can't get him on the phone now that he's retired. It's impossible to get him. He's too busy making like fried eggplant for the family
fishing
and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So the history. So we've talked about how it became, how it got turned into a site that would be moving from the initial airport into finally the Coliseum, and we've the high point as far as in sports. But I see, and you've opened it up here. There's been a lot of other kinds of performance history at the Coliseum. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So beyond hockey, I mean, we all know the Islanders won 4 Stanley Cups in a row in the early 1980s. They became one of the greatest dynasties in sports and produced a lot of famous players, Mike Bossy, Bob Nystrom, Clark Gillies, Dennis Poffman, Billy Smith. But I wanted to make sure I also included the concerts and include photos from different concerts to show that there are a lot of famous performers who also went to the Coliseum. So even though it has that sort of bad reputation.
It's funny because when I looked at the layout of the con, which your book also has, it shows the whole layout of the, of it. It reminded me very much of a venue that I used to go to when I was, when I was a teenager, early 20s in Florida. But of course it was like nothing of the same quality. It was basically, you know, and in Florida you can get away with that. It's basically, it's like a stadium with a tin roof on it.
Okay.
And you could pay the price for that kind of construction. I remember seeing the Police and Sting having to get out of the way of this water dripping right where his mic stood and to avoid electrocution. But
I think that those kinds of stories and those memories are what make a place like Nassau College seem so interesting. Because so many people have gone there, whether it's for a concert or a hockey game or a circus or a convention, and you have a memory of something that happened. And it's kind of cool when it is a memory of rain leaking onto the stage as opposed to just...
Well, that's the Hollywood Sportatorium, but what are some of the stories from the Coliseum?
Some of the, I guess, performers that are just so famous who were there. I mean, we start out with Elvis Presley, Bob Dylan.
So Elvis must have been there. I guess that's the late part of the career.
This is... At the end of his career, if you look at the photo, you see that he's a little bit portly.
Yeah, he's got the gut.
Yep.
And the Elvis in Vegas white suit.
This is from 1973. I guess just an interesting story is that he was supposed to perform there right before he died. So one of his next concerts was supposed to be at Nassau Coliseum. It was in 1977. And even though the concert never occurred, 5,000 fans went to the parking lot of the Coliseum and held a memorial service.
How touching.
So, again, that's sort of a shared experience that people had, and they would come to that arena to just be with each other and, I guess, grieve for somebody who, for a lot of them, meant more than just someone you listen to.
Well, he played a very large part in their lives.
Yeah.
See Dylan there.
Right, so moving on to Dylan, you have in 1974 George Harrison from the Beatles and Paul McCartney performing separately because at that time they were sort of on the outs.
I guess the Beatles never played Nassau Coliseum.
Not as a group because they were... They predate the Coliseum in a sense.
Oh, exactly, right. That's right. They stopped touring in 66. They stopped performing as a group in 66 to focus on their studio career. So.
Sure. But you see the profile of the Coliseum early on, that they're attracting this caliber of a performer.
Right.
That it is a major sports and entertainment arena. It's not just, you know, your neighborhood place. So Freddie Mercury, Eric Clapton, Peter, Paul, and Mary, just goes on and on into more modern musicians. I have Michael Jackson performing with the Jackson 5.
I noticed that there was a lot of images. I was kind of impressed by that, that there was a lot of images in the book. And was this through Mr. Elder that you got a lot of... Oh, I saw there was... When we're looking at some of the construction there or the aviation stuff, there's a museum out there, I guess, that you got some of these images from.
The aviation photos are from the Cradle of Aviation Museum in Garden City, New York. If you've ever been to the Coliseum, they have what they call Museum Row, which is nearby, includes the Cradle Aviation. So, yes, they were able to provide a lot of photos very graciously, but some of them really came from random archives around the country.
So it took a lot of going through files, dustbins of images. And
Lance gave me about 3 or 4 boxes of old photos and magazines and programs and things that he had collected from his time at the Coliseum. And he had a friend who had worked with him at the Coliseum, a guy named Rich Walker, who took a lot of concert photos. So a lot of the later concert images that you see from the 90s are from Rich.
AC/DC?
Van Halen.
Van Halen.
Van Halen there, yeah.
looking at it upside down.
Yeah.
Trying to figure out. I was thinking Led Zeppelin for a minute, but
although they performed there too.
Yeah, no.
But yeah, so he had a lot of those images. But I think one of the interesting things about the book also is that I was able to call it together from so many different sources. So you have archives in California and New York, just different collectors. So it's probably the first time that all of these images have been together in one place.
This is a great A-list, and I wonder if somebody would go through here. For example, you know, in my day, what we did is we collected ticket stubs,
mm-hmm.
and you would have them at your house, you know, probably like pinned to the wall. But I'm sure you'd find somebody out there who probably attended most of these concerts. So sure. I guess it would have been, if you're not necessarily going to get somebody who goes to see, AC/DC, go see the Sinatra performance
right.
in 77, but still.
But to show, I guess, that diversity of performers, too, that they were attracting. And that's interesting, too, when you look at some of the people who are performing on consecutive nights. Totally different. I mean, one night you have Garth Brooks, and then the next night it's Metallica. But that's the glory of a major arena.
And I guess they had, I see also the American Soccer League at one point. Indoor soccer league, or seeing some images of that.
Yes.
That's something that didn't take off. Well, and I guess now we were talking about this, the Nets, for example, who played an integral role in the need for this space, then eventually left. And so it's been basically the home of the Islanders since then.
Pretty much exclusively, although there have been a lot of smaller teams, you know, teams that we don't hear about as often, but they have had soccer.
Right.
Played there. Tennis even played there for a while. The New York Sets, they were called, and Billie Jean King was on the team.
Oh, yeah.
And Virginia Wade, so you have some tennis greats. Of course, there's so much wrestling that's gone on there over the years. There's photos in the book of Andre the Giant and Bruno Sammartino. And then going on to 1986, WrestleMania II was hosted at the Coliseum.
I mean, I remember Bruno. I think I saw Bruno at Boston Garden,
mm-hmm.
where the... I guess you know, I realize now I've lived in Boston for about 3 years of my life in the 70s. But I remember, yeah, Bruno Sammartino, yeah. Definitely. Wrestling, yeah, I think that was another role Sportatorium in Hollywood played as well. Well, we're coming to close to the end of our hour, so I wanted to just offer a couple of options here. I don't know if there's another passage you're interested in reading, or if you want to talk about other projects that you're working on now.
Sure, I'll talk about some of the other projects. Well, since my day job is a reporter at the New York Daily News, I've been writing a few different series over the last few years about historic preservation in Queens. So that's really my focus, is buildings, again, sort of like Nassau Coliseum, that are underappreciated and need to be landmarked to preserve their history or at least deserve some sort of recognition. So I did a series in 2008 that was called History in Peril that was all about historic buildings in Queens that aren't city landmarks, which means that they could be demolished or altered at any moment and we'd lose all of that, which has happened before. And now I'm writing a series called Queens Heritage Quest, which is about sites that may not even be a building, but they deserve some sort of historical signage or maybe a podcast link trail or tour. Something so at least people know in their communities what went on there. Because I think that happens with the Coliseum, too, and with all of these sites, sort of that common thread.
They get forgot.
Yeah, they're just forgotten, or you pass by it all the time and you don't really know what happened there. I think that it looks like a big arena. Something big must have happened, but I don't know what.
Sometimes it happens to me. Like, I was driving down Atlantic Avenue, I think, one day on the way back from JFK through Brooklyn, and I saw some sort of factory, and I was like, what was that? Like, in fact, now they're closing down the Hostess factory, and that's a major issue in the community.
I actually wrote a story about the Wonder Bread plant that's
right,
closing
exactly,
in Jamaica,
yeah.
Queens, that ran in yesterday's paper. So,
yeah, so that's, you know, that's a major. And it just brings me back, because I've just been listening to Moynihan's speeches on, you know, New York being a town that makes things and how, you know, that was going away, and even in his day.
Sure.
Well, listening to you talk, it just, you know, some of the few things I was thinking of was our own LaGuardia Wagner archives here at the college, and another colleague of mine in the photo program, Javier Larenas, who's been on my show in the past, who's actually working on a project documenting WPA murals around Queens, which I was surprised how many he found. And, you know, some of them, of course, are in buildings. Some are in buildings where, if the work is not at least preserved, the building is still functioning, and maybe it needs preserving. But he, in some cases, we're looking at buildings that are like shut down, and he has to find ways to get into them to document these works. And you, it's actually, you know, that always gets my interest because I love the work of the WPA. I just think it was one of the great, you know, one of the great times where the government actually did something worthwhile
that's still
with
around
the money. Yeah, and it
decades later.
Well, if you can find it, if you can get to, I think of the. For like the Farm Securities Administration, you know, archive that's at the Library of Congress is, you know, something that needs to be taken care of. So that's just a couple of things I was thinking. I don't know if you may want to meet Javier sometime.
Certainly. I think it's great that he's doing that because so many people seem to focus on Manhattan, and it's natural because of where we are. So we go into Manhattan for restaurants or shows, and we think of all the museums and institutions, but Queens has its own history, too, and if we don't really cherish it, then it's going to lose it, and that's what's happened in the past. So if we just forget about a building for decades, it's going to crumble. One of the stories that I've covered often is the New York State Pavilion in Flushing Meadows Corona Park. So if you've been to the park near the Unisphere, there's those towers from Men in Black. Those,
right, yeah, they turn into spaceships.
Exactly. If you've ever watched Men in Black, they turn into spaceships. They were in Iron Man 2 recently well, last summer. And it was a pavilion from 1964. It looks like it's an ancient pavilion because it's just in such bad shape.
Yeah.
And that's a city property that just has been neglected for decades. And the whole point of journalism is to call attention to this and say, hey, something smells bad here. Let's fix this.
Well, I remember, remembering the Rick Burns documentary on New York, Jane Jacobs. You know, if Jane, you know, this is the other side of Moses.
Of Robert Moses.
Which
sure.
is if Jane Jacobs had not stood up for the West Village.
It would be a highway, right?
Yeah, in Soho and all these places, there would be an off-ramp for the FDR, the West Side Highway. And we saw it, you know, I worked in the Bronx and worked in communities that paid a price for Moses' success, the East Tremont neighborhoods, some Bathgate, places like that. So, it takes somebody, and you might actually, another person you might want to talk to is Fern Luskin, who's in my department here in Humanities, who is single-handedly trying to preserve a building across the street from her, you know, turning it into landmark status. So she's got a little taste of what it's like to work with the, you know, New York City committees on trying
Landmarks Preservation Commission,
which is what it, you know, is a whole another world of things to try to work through.
Mm-hmm.
But in the last 3 minutes, anything else you want to talk about things you might want to read or anything like that?
Sure. Well, I would just encourage people, if you've had any experience at the Coliseum, at least give this book a try, pick it up at a bookstore.
Well, Islander fans, it's a natural. Have you considered, and since this is in some ways a shameless self-promotion, but, you know, to maybe market it at the stadium, has there been that consideration?
There's talks. There are, according to a source of knowledge of the situation, there are talks.
I would think so.
To have it sold at Nassau Coliseum. But right now, if you are interested, go to Amazon.com. You can go to my website. It's nickhirshon.com. So NickHirshon.com. And there's a Facebook group, Facebook page, actually, that has all the information about it.
And what's, you know, what's interesting, you know, my chair, Michael Rodriguez, is always talking about how you know, I mean, this thing, you were an adjunct, and, you know, a lot of times, just like our students, there are these ideas that people get about adjuncts, but, you know, they end up, you know, without them, this place could not run. The numbers of students that we work with, we have to have adjuncts as part of the workforce. But on top of that is that when you start looking at the work that people are doing in their disciplines that, you know, adjuncts are publishing, receiving grants in very large percentages, which rival if they don't actually supersede full-time faculty a lot of times. Because, you know, now that I'm full-time, I realize full faculty have a lot of things that they're asked to do, and sometimes it gets in the way.
Sure.
Whereas adjuncts though I'm sure you'd like to be working more in teaching, sometimes can find opportunities for your own work.
Right.
And so it's exciting that, you know, to be published, which is something that folks are working towards in tenure. You're on the front end of that.
Sure.
But of course, if you ended up on the tenure line, you, next project.
Right.
So, but it's exciting to see somebody who's publishing.
Yeah, it's great. And also the experiences that I have every day, I feel, whether it's in publishing or just reporting for the Daily News, something you can bring into the classroom. So it's not just teaching out of a textbook, an abstract example of...
And that's what students want.
Yeah, and it's great for me because I'm just pretty much telling you how my day went, you know, or a story that I enjoyed writing. But for them, I guess it's something that they're not used to hearing.
And
so.
I used to take students on field trips to locations for photography courses. And of course, I do that now with art, to museums. But is there anything to see now when they go to the Daily News building as far as production anymore? Is everybody working from their homes at this point?
You know, there's a series of different bureaus. I work out of the Queens Bureau, which would probably disappoint them if they saw it. I mean, it's
office,
I love it.
With computers.
We have a great view. We can see we can see all of Queens Boulevard and the Unisphere and things like that. But I do try to encourage them to get out there, try to freelance pieces for the Queens weekly newspapers. There's so many options since we're in New York City. Take advantage of it. Write for The Bridge, which is the student newspaper at LaGuardia, or just go out there and try to pitch the story that you want to write for class. You know, I don't have a problem. It's actually advisable. You get extra credit if you get it published.
And I've always pushed when I was working with the radio club to get into broadcast reporting as well, that these stories from The Bridge could find them, you know, the reporters could come on and read them on the air and make that part of the experience too.
And that's the next wave of journalism, of course, is there's no one who's just sitting now being a reporter at a computer. It's you've got to report the story and write it, but also work on some podcast or some sometimes video element for the website.
Wear a lot of hats.
Yeah, it's challenging, but I guess it's also a rewarding idea when you complete it. Yeah, it should excite you. And if it's a story that you care about, I think you're going to want to show it off in different platforms and see that audio and video add something that you just don't get sometimes with print.
Well, it's been fun talking about this, and good to meet you.
Yes,
and,
thank you very much.
Mazel tov on your publication. And so I've been talking to, and this is a pre-recorded interview with Nicholas Hersham, which will be played back on my show hopefully tomorrow morning. But I wanted to thank you for being my guest.
Thank you very much.
And if you're interested in the book, check it out. I'll be talking about it as well. Images of America series, Nassau Veterans Memorial Coliseum from Nicholas Hersham, with a foreword by Lance W. Elder.
Yes.
Hats off to former faculty members. So there you have it, our pre-recorded interview with adjunct professor of English here at LaGuardia Community College, Nicholas Hersham, and his book, Images of America series, Nassau Veterans Memorial Coliseum, which is available. And if you're interested, you can check it out on Amazon or go check out Nick's website, as he listed for you. But I wanted to end the show with another recording, another Billy Joel, which I failed to mention. The significance of the Billy Joel recording, besides being live at the Nassau, is live at the Nassau Coliseum. And we were listening to it from, I think it was the 77 recording. So we're going to go out with another live recording from 82. Yes, the significance of one of the things retired in the rafters of the Coliseum is Billy Joel himself, who has played, I guess, a significant number of shows there to merit that, like and some of the Islander numbers and jerseys are up there as well. So I just wanted to say thanks for listening. You've been listening to How It Works with me, your host, Hugo Fernandez, here on LaGuardia Web Radio, WLGCC, and to a pre-recorded interview of Nicholas Hersham, writer, professor of the Nassau Veterans Memorial Coliseum publication in the Images of America series. So just want to say thanks for listening.
White, a bottle of red, Perhaps a bottle of rosé instead. Get a table near the streets at our old familiar place. You and I, face to face. A bottle of red, a bottle of white. It all depends upon your appetite. I'll meet you anytime you want in our Italian restaurant.
Oh, that's all I heard about Brenda and Eddie. Can you get more?
after all.